Hey, good afternoon or morning, everybody. For those on the West Coast, good morning. For those on the East Coast, good afternoon. It's wonderful to be with you again as we continue this series of Poskim and Psakim. So again, we're discussing different Rabbanim and their Piskei Halacha, different great Poskim and their Piskei Halacha. So this month we're going to do probably one of the least famous, I guess, nowadays, of the personalities that we've learned about so far, but definitely one of the most interesting of the personalities. I don't really have a full handle on him, and that is Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger Zatzal. Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger is not as well known, as I mentioned, as some of the others that we've discussed, but he's super interesting and super innovative. He lived from 1837 to 1922. His father was Rav Yechiel Schlesinger, was a close Talmud of the Chassam Sofer, and was a rabbi in Pressburg, not the Rav of Pressburg, but sort of a rabbinical functionary in Pressburg. As a child, he was raised with very little gashmius. His grandfather would wake him at midnight, and they would be misabel on the Churban Abayis, and his main rebbe was his father, and he would always, throughout his life, recognize his father as his primary rebbe, even though other rebbeim came in and out of his life. And that's where he really got a sense of Yiddishkeit and really a sense of the legacy of the Chassam Sofer. Rav Schlesinger attended a secular school at some point where he learned to read and write German, and he mastered mathematics. He was really, really strong in mathematics. And then after attending the yeshiva of the Ksav Sofer in Pressburg, he learned a little bit with Rav Chaim Sofer, as well as with Rav Moshe Shik, the Maharam Shik, another of the prime Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer. So his Torah lineage certainly goes back to the Chassam Sofer, and he certainly fits in that vein of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah and all of that that we normally associate with Chassam Sofer, the tremendous distaste or absolute rejection of reform and tremendous distaste for a certain amount of modernity that he carried with him for his whole life. He then went to a different yeshiva at some point, the yeshiva of Rav Shlomo Ketch, and that was an interesting choice because that yeshiva had a certain reputation for openness to general culture, which was not something that was common in Hungary. And Rav Schlesinger later wrote that at that stage in his life, he really considered following a more modern form of Orthodox Judaism, and it gave him insight into the mindset of those who would be, who might succumb to the temptations of a more modern type of Judaism. And eventually, he came back to Pressburg, and he was ordained by the Ksav Sofer. Where the Ksav Sofer wrote Yerasso Kodemes L'Chachmaso, that he had a tremendous amount of Yerushamayim, and the Ksav Sofer trusted him with learning with his son. So he was clearly a prime disciple of the Ksav Sofer. However, the Ksav Sofer became very upset with him at a certain point in time because the Ksav Sofer's niece became engaged to Rav Schlesinger, and the Ksav Sofer didn't think Rav Schlesinger had the financial ability to support his niece, so he objected to the shidduch, and there was some resentment because of that. It was tempered a little bit because Rav Schlesinger really did love the Ksav Sofer, but there was some lingering resentment because of that. In 1860, Rav Schlesinger married Liba, who was the daughter of Rav Hillel Lichtenstein, who was then the Rav of a small community in eastern Hungary. And when Rav Lichtenstein's wife died, when Rav Hillel Lichtenstein's wife died, he married Rav Schlesinger's younger sister, Freidel. So try to draw that family tree. Here, Rav Schlesinger was married to the daughter of Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein then married the sister of Rav Schlesinger. So Rav Lichtenstein was at once Rav Schlesinger's father-in-law and brother-in-law at the same time. He had a similar type of family dynamic with the Netziv with the Netziv and the sister of the Aruch HaShulchan, if I'm not mistaken, a similar type of family dynamic. Now, Rav Kivi Yosef followed the family tradition, and he did not want to consider the rabbinate as a career, and instead he became Rav Lichtenstein's right-hand man as a dayan in his Beis Din, a Magid Shir in his yeshiva, and that's what he did for most of the time that he remained in Hungary. Then he started publishing, and once he started publishing, he really put himself on the map and ruffled a lot of feathers. He wrote in 1863, he published a book called Tzava'as Moshe, V'nilve Elav Sefer Nar Ivri. It was basically the Hebrew text of the Chassam Sofer's Tzava'a, of his last will and testament, with an appendix of his own. And it wasn't so successful. But the following year, he was more successful, and he had a text of the Chassam Sofer's Tzava'a with a running commentary called Lev HaIvri. Ivri was a nutrikin for his name, because it's Akiva Yosef Ben Rabbi Yechiel. So it's Ivri, Ayin, Yud, Beis, Reish, Yud, Akiva Yosef Ben Rabbi Yechiel. And then the second part followed in 1866, and Rav Schlesinger had a very strong, unbridled condemnation of assimilation and of reform, and attacks on any sense of modernity, and it really became a bestseller, because he had a very, very sharp pen that people took to. He very strongly argued that the basic markers of Judaism were Shaloshinu Hashemam, Shaloshinu Haslashonam, Shaloshinu Hasmalbusham. That's Shalem in Shame, Lashon and Malbush, Shin Lamed Mem. That's what makes a complete Jew. That's what makes someone a full Jew. When someone is Shalem in all of those areas of Shame, Lashon and Malbush, a person has to dress like a Jew and talk like a Jew and carry a Jewish name. For him, that was absolutely paramount. He published another pamphlet, Chevra Machzirei Atara LeYoshna, in 1863, that outlined the need for the from people to organize, and it called for masses in the East who are untouched by modernity to give spiritual and material support to those who are threatened by modernity in the West. And it provided safe asylum to people who are trying to escape from the intervention of cultural demands of a modern nation state. And he thought it was they were being polluted, with all these foreign ideas, and they should leave behind that entire environment for a more pristine spiritual environment. But then he really, really, really made his name in Eretz Yisrael. In 1870, he and his family made Aliyah. They moved to Yerushalayim, and he was initially very well accepted. He was hailed as a celebrity in certain circles, and within 2 years, he was fighting the good fight against much of the establishment of Eretz Yisrael, as well as Chutz Laaretz. He was an arch enemy of Rav Israel Hildesheimer, and the whole model of Torah Derech Eretz. He was very unsatisfied with the conditions in Eretz Yisrael at the time. The Chalukah system, which was in place, which distributed tzedakah that came from Chutz Laaretz and was controlled by certain overseers that were not the Memunim, the people who were in charge of it, were not to his liking at all, and he thought it was a corrupt system. Many of the kolels tried to discourage people from coming to Eretz Yisrael by denying them Chalukah during the initial years of their stay in Eretz Yisrael, and he thought that this was criminal. He thought that this was economically disastrous, it was unjust, and he became very, very much someone who believed in pushing forward the agenda of Mashiach, of the arrival of Mashiach. He was a big follower of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer's messianism, and it called for a real restoration of the Jewish people making Aliyah and coming back to Eretz Yisrael, creating agricultural settlements. You know, it's very hard for us sometimes in the year 2022 to look back and say, like, okay, so what was this person? Was he like modern Orthodox? Was he Haredi? Was he, because we have like our own dividing lines. And, you know, here you have a person whose messianic Zionism was stronger than anybody else's at the time. So that, you know, that maybe resonates with certain types of people. But at the same time, he was an absolute Chasam Sofer, Nick. He was a Chadash Asim in HaTorah, and he fighted all secularism. And he was, so it was a very, very interesting mix, at least from a modern perspective. It was a very, very interesting mix. And even the truth is, from his own perspective, from the perspective of his time, it was also a very interesting mix of things. But he was very much into pushing for agricultural settlements in Eretz Yisrael, and his Chevra Machziri HaTorah LeYoshna incorporated a lot of strands of his thought, suggesting that they create this type of very frum utopia with a lot of the elements of what we would think of as a modern Jewish state. He wanted Hebrew language, he wanted Jewish attire, he wanted a flag, he wanted a militia, he wanted like an elected assembly, like a governing body that would secure Jewish culture in Eretz Israel. He didn't outright call for a Jewish state initially, but then later in later letters he made it explicit that he wanted a Jewish state in Eretz Israel. However, he had serious controversies that surrounded him. There were four controversies in particular, maybe one of which we'll really dwell on at length. The four controversies, just to say them, say what they are first, and then we'll go through them one by one, were his willingness or desire to get rid of the Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom against marrying multiple wives. If you can imagine that, that would be a controversial stand. He wanted to reintroduce Korban Pesach. He was a maverick. I mean, he was suggesting things that hadn't been done. He was a big supporter of Tcheles, of the Radzina Rebbe's Tcheles, and he wanted to reintroduce blowing shofar in Yerushalayim when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, to blow the shofar on Shabbos. And that probably was the most famous of all of the things that he did, because it caused a huge discussion among the other Rabbanim of the time. Wait a second, we don't blow shofar on Shabbos, but if someone's going to do it, should we at least go listen? Meaning, it's still a mitzvah d'oraisa that's being fulfilled. We don't do it because of a gzeira, Shema Yavirenu, Dalet Amos, Rosh Hashanah. You might come to carry the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. But some we're not going to do it, but he's going to do it. So should we at least go listen? So let's go through each of these controversies one by one. They're, each one is fascinating. In 1875, Rav Schlesinger published a work called Beis Yosef Chadash, and it went beyond all of his previous vilifications of acculturation and reform, but had this wild proposal to suspend in Eretz Yisrael the Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom on marrying two wives. Why? What would prompt someone to do that? To suggest that people should be able to marry more than one wife? So in Russia at the time, there was forced conscription into the army for a 25-year period, which is essentially a Jewish death sentence. Some people were taken as young as the age of 8 and started to be trained as soldiers. So some people would flee Russia and move to Israel to avoid being drafted into the Russian army. And at the time, a lot of their wives refused to come with them. So Rav Schlesinger discusses the possibility. Here you have these people that have wives back in Russia, but they have no access to these wives that are back in Russia. They've arrived in Eretz Yisrael because they're trying to save their spiritual lives by arriving in Eretz Yisrael, and now they can't get on with their lives. They can't marry anybody. So he discussed the possibility of getting around the Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom of two wives. His enemies, Rav Schlesinger's enemies, accused him of doing away with and not respecting the Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom, and that this was a terrible thing to do. So that was one major controversy. Another major controversy is, he was not the only one that suggested this, but he was one of those who advocated for bringing back the Korban Pesach on the Har HaBayis. because the halacha is that you can be makrav a korban Pesach even when there's no Beis Hamikdash, as long as you do it on the Har HaBayis. Most people found that to be, after 1900 years of not bringing korban Pesach, found that to be like off the reservation, that you're going to go start bringing the korban Pesach. And that was also, there's a major halachic literature on that topic, also its own fascinating topic. A third thing that got him into trouble was the reintroduction of Tcheles, which of course is a mitzvah d'oraisa to wear Tcheles, but the practice died out because we lost the ability to find the dye. In the 19th century, though, the famous Ritzinger Rebbe claimed that he had rediscovered the ancient Tcheles, which he was able to make, he claimed came from a squid, and his followers began wearing, and Ara Yom Hazeh, the Ritzinger Chassidim wear the Ritzinger Tcheles, even though the Ritzinger Tcheles has been proven to be inauthentic. But Rav Zina Rebbe, when he came out with this Tcheles, he sent letters to all the Gedolei Torah of the generation, asking them to accept his Tcheles. Rav Schlesinger brought the dye to Yerushalayim at the beginning of the 1890s, and that enraged many of the very frum Haredi elite in Yerushalayim, especially Rav Hillel Meshel Gelbstein, who was a follower of the Kutzker, which was a rival Hasidus, and in a very serious attack, Rav Gelbstein denounced this Tcheles and said that anyone who wears it is an Ovid Avodah Zarah, and since pagans cannot be accepted as Edim under Halacha, so he said that Rav Schlesinger cannot be consulted as, he cannot be used as a posek in any realm, and someone stormed into Shachris where Rav Schlesinger was davening, and these Talmidim or followers of Rav Gelbstein, and they ripped off his Rav Schlesinger's talus right off of his shoulders, and there was a fist fight that ensued, and they brought the talus to Rav Gelbstein, and he treated it like one would treat anything that was tikrovas avodah zarah. He burnt it. He said, this is a matter of avodah zarah. I don't know, really understand why it would be avodah zarah, but that's what he said. And to make his point perfectly clear, he destroyed it publicly on the flat roof of the Churva Shul above the main square of the old city. And another example, this is just another example of how Tcheles was typically adopted by those who were most pushing for Mashiach, meaning who were most active in pushing for Mashiach. And we find that even Bizmanenu, that even though it's really an independent discussion, but whether the Tcheles that we have is the genuine article or not, but generally speaking, when Tcheles is reintroduced, you find that people who take to it are more aligned with a sense of Zionism and of Mashiach coming in general, but not 100% obviously, and the two conversations are not necessarily associated with each other. Happens to be, just parenthetically, I was at a chasana recently and I saw Rav Daniel Stein, who I see all the time in yeshiva, obviously he's one of our Rashi yeshiva, one of our outstanding Rashi yeshiva, and he told me that he once asked Rav Palm, the Cardinal of Racha, about the Murex Trunculus Tcheles that we wear nowadays, or I shouldn't suggest we wear, that I wear nowadays, that Moreno Agon Rav Shechter Shlita wears nowadays. He said that Rav Stein said that as a Talmud Rav Shechter, when he first got engaged, he was wearing Tcheles, and his father-in-law said, "What's this Tcheles? What's this all about?" So he said, "Rav Shechter wears it." He tried to explain it. His father-in-law said, "Well, I never heard of this. Where is this coming from?" So he decided to send letters to all the Gedolei Yisrael that were alive at that time. It was around the turn of the century. It was around the year 2000 when Rav Stein got engaged, and they sent letters to everybody, to every major Gadol, and no one wrote back except for Rav Palm. Rav Palm wrote back and said, "I'm just too weak to really write out my full opinion, but you're welcome to come talk to me." so you can come to my house and talk to me. So Rav Stein said that he and his father-in-law went to Rav Palm's house to talk to him, and they asked Rav Palm what he thought about the Tchelis. And I think the way Rav Stein said it was, Rav Palm said, look, I'm too old and too weak to really look into all of the Tainas this way, that way, you know, back and forth, but I don't think we should wear it. He said, because look, the Radzina Rebbe thought that he found the Tchelis, and it turned out to not be correct. And then Rav Herzog thought he found, and it also turned out to not be correct. He said, even if it seems that it's correct, it's too risky. You know, if we get it wrong again, if the Rabbanim get it wrong again, then the Balabatim are going to start asking, what else did you get wrong? What else did the Rabbanim not know? We're going to lose all credibility. So he thought it was just too risky to wear tchelis. I thought that was an interesting taina, one that I had never heard before against the wearing of the tchelis. But anyway, then there was the fourth controversy, and this is the psak that really shook the world. And that was the willingness to blow shofar on Shabbos. Rav Tukachinsky discusses this in a Sefer Ir HaKodesh B'Hamikdash, where he says that Rav Schlesinger had such a she'ifa to establish Tkiyah Shofar in Yerushalayim on Shabbos. In 1880, he published a kuntras to encourage people to do this, and it caused a huge ruckus among the Gedolei Yerushalayim. Many people bought into Rav Schlesinger's arguments, and he wanted to gather 23 people, form a Sanhedrin in order to do it, but most of them didn't show up on the day that they were supposed to, because they didn't want to take on the establishment to go against everybody. Supposedly, he still did it in private, but not clear. So, what's it based on? Following the Churban HaBayis, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai made a takana that the shofar should be blown on Shabbos wherever there was a Beis Din, Kamakom Sheish Bo Beis Din. And what he was referring to was the main Beis Din of the time, where they would be Mechadish the Chadashim, and where the Dayanim had Smicha, you know, going back Ishmi Piyish from Moshe Rabbeinu, and wherever that Beis Din was, whether it's in Yavne or somewhere else, they'd blow the shofar. If the Beis Din was no longer sitting there, then you weren't allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos. So the Rif, who was obviously one of the greatest Rishonim, held that even after the Smicha was broken, the shofar should still be blown in any important Beis Din. And the Rif, you know, any Beis Din Chashuv. And the Rif followed that Shitah, and in his Beis Din, they blew shofar on Rosh Hashanah, even on Shabbos, because it was a Beis Din Chashuv. But all the other Rishonim disagreed with the Rif, and they said, no, you're only allowed to blow shofar in a Beis Din that's made up of people who have smicha that goes back Ishmi Piyush to Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore we don't have any such Beis Din that you can blow shofar in. So even the Talmidim of the Rif didn't follow this minig of the Rif. So Rav Schlesinger made basically a 3-point argument to blow the shofar. He says, first of all, the original halacha that allows blowing shofar in Yerushalayim and its surrounding areas was still in effect even after the Churban. Second of all, we saw that the Chachamim didn't want to end blowing shofar. They just transferred it to Kol Makom Sheyesh Bo Beis Din. So you see, clearly they were trying to hold on to Tkiyah Shofar on Shabbos. So he felt that in his time, where there were no Dayanim Smuchim, the shofar should be blown in the Beis Din of Yerushalayim, because that would be a Beis Din Chashuv. And finally, he said, the mitzvah of blowing shofar is a mitzvah d'oraisa. The isser of blowing shofar on Shabbos is d'rabanan. So at least be moded that it's a suffix, whether we should do it. And if it's a suffix, we should say suffix d'oraisa l'chumra. So we should blow shofar even on Shabbos. And he took great pains to explain exactly how to implement shofar blowing in a way that people wouldn't violate carrying on Shabbos. You don't have to worry about Shemi Avirenu. So there were a lot of Rabbanim that had that expressed interest and support for Rav Schlesinger. But those who disagreed with him really prevailed, and the shofar was not, it seems, at least publicly, not blown on Shabbos. The main reason is because we don't have smuchim, and they thought that without smuchim, it cannot be done. The Adera says that even though he didn't agree with Rosh Schlesinger when he was dying, and he thought that it might be his last chance to hear shofar, and it happened to have been that Rosh Hashanah fell on Shabbos, that he said, if Rosh Schlesinger does it, I'm going to hide behind a wall and I'm going to listen. Meaning, I'm not going to appear publicly, but if it's my last chance to get the mitzvah d'oraisa, then he would do that. That was the that's what the Adaras, I think in Yira Kodesh V'Amikdash, he records, that's what the Adaras had said. So there's a huge literature, fascinating discussion. If the Rabbanan say that you're not allowed to blow shofar, and you hold that you're not allowed to because of a gzeira, you might carry it for Amos and Rosh Hashanah. But you do it anyway. So do we say, look, you did the wrong thing, but you still get the mitzvah d'oraisa, because the Rabbanim can't just, you know, make a mitzvah d'oraisa disappear? Or do we say, no, that since you went against the way the Rabbanim told you to do something, therefore you don't even get the mitzvah d'oraisa, that the Rabbanim are authorized to rob you of your mitzvah d'oraisa, to take away any kiyum d'oraisa you would get from shofar. So in the Kuntras Kava du Koshyasa, Simon Sadi Tes, Kava du Koshyasa was written by a Talmud of, but it was written by the Chalkas Yoav, the Talmud of the Avnei Nezer. And it's basically 103 questions to which he does not have answers. But he assumes in Simon Sadi Tes of the Kava du Koshyasa that the Rabbanon can be oker a mitzvah daraisa, that they have the ability to uproot a mitzvah daraisa, which is against what Rabbi Kiva Eger writes in Drush Mechidish and what the Avnei Nezer writes in that you still would fulfill a mitzvah d'oraisa. The Kavod Kushyasa brings a raya from Tosos and Masechah Sukkah Dav Gimel, because Tosos there says explicitly that you don't get a mitzvah d'oraisa if you sit in a sukkah with Rosh of Ruba B'sukaso V'Shulchano B'toch Habayis, when your shulchan is in the house, when you're sitting like on the border of your sukkah and your house, and your table is in your house. Why? Because there's a gzeru midrabanan shema yimashaych achar shulchanu, you might end up sitting in the house. But midaraisa, you're fulfilling the mitzvah. Tosa says, you don't even get the mitzvah daraisa, because you didn't do the mitzvah the way the Rabbanan wanted you to do the mitzvah. And therefore, says the Kavod Kashyasa, you see that if the Rabbanan tell you to do a mitzvah in a certain way, and you don't follow their rules in how to do the mitzvah, you don't even get credit for the mitzvah on a daraisa level. Rav Asher Weiss has a beautiful essay where he defends the shita of Rabbi Kiva Eger from Tosfos, and he points out that Tosfos only relates to a certain type of dinim drabanan, where he would say that you would lose the credit for a daraisa, but there are different types of dinim drabanan, and they're not all the same. There are takarnas drabanan, there's takarnas hashuk, there's takarnas hashavim. There are all different types of dinim drabanan, and they're not all the same. Ratzi Pesach Frankim Mekray Kodesh on page Kuf Zayin says that the rabanan will be ma'amid divrayim b'makom daraisa when it's a psul in the cheftza, like a sukkah, but when it's a din in the gavra, like shofar on Shabbos, then the rabanan will not take away your din d'oraisa. And then another interesting psak this is poskim and psakim, not poskim and psak. So let's just mention another interesting psak that Rav Schlesinger had. He has a tshuva in his sefer Simon Reish Yud Gimel and Shalos Tshuvos Rabbi Akiva Yosef. You could find it on Hebrew books, where he was asked about a community where there was a wealthy man that had dalad minim on sukkis, and no one else had dalad minim. And every year, this guy would lend out his dalad minim to other people to be yotze the mitzvah. However, va'ata erev chag hasukos. Now it's erev chag hasukos yotze ketata b'neiyam b'erev chag. There was a huge fight. Ubarabo chamaso shalagvir. And this gavir, who was the only guy in town that had dalad minim, got angry. V'nodar shalolos islam esrog. He took a nether. I'm not giving my esrog to anybody. And no one had an esrog except for this guy. So they wanted to know, is there any eitzah of how we can get his esrog from him? Because the din is, on the first day of Yantav, it needs to be lachem, it needs to belong to you. How can we get the esrog from this guy? So he suggested three possibilities, each one more surprising than the previous one. First one he suggests, maybe wait for the guy to give it to his own family member to use. Because in order for his family members to use it, he has to give it to them as a matana al menas lahachzir, so that it will be lachem, it will belong to them. And while the family member is using it, before he returns it back to this gavir, the family member could give it to whoever he wants to. So maybe the gavir is not going to be reasonable, so you won't have what to talk to him about. But if you could convince one of his children to be willing to share it around while he has access to it, that would be good enough. He quotes a Siddur Derech HaChaim, that if the owner of the Esrog, if the Gvir would try to give it to a family member as a Matan al-Manas Aksir, al Tanai, that he doesn't share it with anybody, then even the family member wouldn't be Yotze. You can't make such a Tanai in a Matan al-Manas Aksir. It has to be a real Matana, just al-Manas Aksir. So that family member should have full rights to do whatever he wants to do with it. Okay. Then he suggests Maybe another etza is you can ask a non-Jew to steal it from the gvir, and then wait for the gvir to be miyaish of ever getting it back, and then get it from the non-Jew, so you'll have yeyush followed by a shinoi rishos, and then you'll be kona it. So he says, I know what you're going to ask. How can you ask a non-Jew to steal something? Isn't that lifnei iver? It's usher for non-Jews to steal also. So isn't it lifnei iver? He says, no, it's not lifnei iver, because the Gemara tells us in Maseches Bamitzia that if a person is gonev al menas lemekat, or gonev al menas lishalem kefel, if a person steals with the best of intentions in mind, let's say I want to give someone tzedakah, he refuses to accept tzedakah from me, so I steal from him so that Beis Din will make me pay back double, and that way I'll give him tzedakah because I'll be paying back double. So it's usher for a Jew to do that. But a Nachri is allowed to steal with the best of intentions in mind. When it's al-Manas, to give it back and to do the best, whatever's best for the community. So you're allowed to ask a Nachri to do this and then wait for the Yeyush followed by the Shinur. It's a wild suggestion. You see, just like his creativity and his, he wasn't afraid of like anything. And then he has a third possibility that we're Kof al-Midas Sodom, and that's enough to transfer the rights of the Esrog and make it Lachem, especially in the case where the mitzvahs of the entire community depend on it. So this is a little bit about Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. He was ultimately forced out of the limelight, and he continued trying to purchase land and establish agricultural settlements in Eretz Yisrael. He never gave up that fight and that push, but he was a major, major posek, someone who was significant and very serious Talmud Chacham, whose Piskei Halacha had to be taken seriously, and someone who would certainly requires much, much more study to have an understanding of his lasting impact. So I thank you all very much for joining me today, and looking forward to next month, Bezos Hashem.
January 15th will be the next year, and we wish Rabbi Lipovitz and everyone a wonderful Hanukkah.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay, and shalom.